First case on calendar this morning is Holman v. State, and that is 69223. If counsel is ready to go, Ms. Yankowski.
Gary Holman. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
There's no reply.
First point, main point, is that there is insufficient evidence. Before I proceed, counsel informed me, and she's correct, that there's something in our brief that's incorrect. On page 7, lines 13 and 14, it says the video appears to depict a shirtless assailant description of appellant. That's incorrect. We've addressed several times about the tank top in the brief, and that was a mistake. So for that, I apologize.
We don't have the video, correct?
Not sure. I don't believe it.
Anyway, proceed with the argument.
There is insufficient evidence to prove that Mr. Holman was guilty of first-degree murder. The evidence that the state had was this tank top that allegedly was worn by Mr. Holman. This knife that was allegedly the murder weapon, which was found in Mr. Holman's apartment. And the cell phone video, which or to determine, but our position is that it does not conclusively show that it's Mr. Holman. Mr. Holman is Hispanic, less than 6 feet, slim build, and has tattoos, and was wearing the tank top, or what's commonly referred to as the wife beater.
With that being said, were there not witnesses to what occurred?
Well, witnesses did identify Mr. Holman, but as the court well knows, eyewitness testimony can be suspect. So, in any event, Mr. Holman was allegedly depicted, but in judicial notice, there is about, as of the 1990 census, there's approximately 84,000 Hispanics in North Las Vegas. Just logically, we'll say half are men, and logically, we'll say half of that is between 18 and 40. And based on that, this video could be depicting some other people that were similarly dressed. The tank top itself was allegedly worn by Mr. Holman. The evidence is undisputed that this person thought by to be Mr. Holman was running. It was hot. Most likely he was sweating. The state recovered the tank top allegedly worn by him. There was DNA analysis. On the DNA analysis, there was blood that belonged to the decedent. However, there was no DNA that pointed to Mr. Holman. While the state says correctly, we don't need DNA to convict someone, that's absolutely correct. However, the state does have the burden of proof, and based on the fact there was no DNA, based on the fact that the tank top was not found on him or at his apartment, it would seem like this is not enough for proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, in addition to the tank top, the evidence on which the state relied was this knife that was found at Mr. Holman's apartment. And the knife didn't have any blood of the decedent, didn't have any fingerprints of Mr. Holman, didn't have any DNA of Mr. Holman. the state continually referred to it as the knife, the murder weapon. Our contention, it was a knife, and there's not enough evidence to conclude that it was the murder weapon. The cell phone video, which the court hasn't seen, we would submit does not conclusively prove it was Mr. Holman.
Well, let's take this back to, say, the early 1900s and assume we didn't have DNA evidence and we didn't have cell phone videos. Is it your position that this conviction could not have been obtained?
Not my position that it could not have been obtained. However, with the advances in science and forensic investigation, these days we need to rely on that also. So
I understand that, but, and I'm certainly not saying something as primitive as you wouldn't have that evidence introduced if it was helpful. But my question is, we're a reviewing court. We're not deciding these facts in the first instance. We're looking at a jury and whether it had sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction it returned. And I guess my problem thinking about this case is there were convictions in the early 20th century that didn't have any of this evidence. Would this case be enough to sustain the conviction under our appellate review standard? If you could address that, that would be helpful to me.
Well, that would rely on some speculation. I believe in the 20s, as the court pointed out, it's hypothetical, that there was fingerprints evidence that could have been used. And if, in fact, there was no fingerprints evidence, then the jury could have found that there was not proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
I'll grant you that. They could have found that, but that's a different question from whether we would reverse on no juror could have found.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with the standards of the day, and I can't effectively opine on what a jury in the 20s may or may not have done.
Mr. Ampelson, I see your position. I believe the standard is, can a reasonable jury interpret the evidence that was submitted be sufficient that the defendant can be convicted beyond a reasonable doubt? It's the standard the jury would look at. You're just saying there was insufficient evidence presented by the state that a jury could even implement that standard.
That's correct.
Okay.
So that is our position. I mean, we had three issues for the court to review that. That's the insufficiency of the evidence. The next issue is, our position is that the autopsy photos were gruesome and unduly prejudicial.
Were they objected to?
I was going to address that. They were not objected to, so they would have to rise to the standard of plain error, and that's all I'll say. Or the same question.
Well, you tried the case.
Yes, I did
try.
You're
a smart attorney, you know.
I hope so.
I mean, I'm just curious. A lot of times we'll get appellate counsel didn't try the case, but why wouldn't you have objected to him?
At that time, and, you know, in retrospect, I probably should have. However, when I try a case, I like to stipulate through as much evidence as possible because it makes the trial go more quickly, and maybe I shouldn't have.
Okay, fair enough.
Whether or not the court deems the photos to rise to plain error, they were admitted. And our position is that with the fact there was no DNA, with the fact that there was nothing on the knife, there were no fingerprints, there was no DNA from Mr. Holman, there was no DNA or blood from the decedent, and the cell phone video, that cumulative Mr. Holman's conviction should be reversed due to the prejudicial effect, the cumulative effect of prejudicial error.
As the argument you're making today, I guess going back to the first point, because you began with whether or not this person of Hispanic descent was recognizable. You had an opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses that purportedly identified your client.
Yes.
Did you have them recanting testimony or indicating they weren't sure or changing?
I did cross-examine all the witnesses that identified Mr. Holman. In fact, there was one witness, and I forget his name, is a Hispanic gentleman. He said the individual, and I don't remember the exact testimony, but he testified that the individual, I believe, wearing a white tank top, or if it was not, an individual that's purported to be Mr. Holman, as blonde and non-Hispanic. So while that was not a recantation per se, that certainly would be an issue for the jury to consider when determining whether Mr. Holman himself was the Hispanic gentleman in the video and whether or not he was the perpetrator. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Any additional?
No, thank you.
Thank you. On behalf of the state.
Eric Mendoza for the state. First of all, in terms of whether or not there's sufficient evidence here, as Your Honor, there was a number of eyewitnesses to this event who did identify the appellant and immediately the day after the murder in a photo lineup. We had two eyewitnesses who observed the actual murder and identified the appellant as the person, as the assailant in that murder. In addition to those eyewitnesses, we had three eyewitnesses who saw the appellant with two other individuals searching the apartment complex for this Shannon person immediately preceding the murder. And there was no dispute that the people involved in the murder were the same people who were looking for Shannon. All of these witnesses also identified the woman that was with the appellant as Mariah White Magpie in both the searching the apartment and during the actual altercation. And there was no dispute that defendant was in a romantic relationship with Mariah White Magpie, and also that appellant had a connection to the Shannon person as well. So in addition to the fact that these people all identified him, we know that appellant had connection to these two very integral people in this whole event. In addition to all of that, Your Honor touched on the cell phone video, which the state's position is that that is absolutely not grainy and unclear. The state's position would be that that video is very clear. You can see the parties.
We can't see it because it's not part of the record, correct?
Correct.
So that defeats our review of it, effectively.
And the defense didn't transmit that to the court. I did bring some screenshots today to refresh defense counsel's recollection as to the fact that he was wearing a tank top in that video. But the witnesses identified the people on the video as the people involved and as the appellant who was sitting in the courtroom at the time. In terms of the witness who defense counsel indicated recanted, it was Francisco Martinez. He was the witness who saw someone throw the white tank top underneath the vehicle away from the murder scene. It wasn't any of the actual witnesses to the murder. And in terms of his recantation, what happened was he said on the stand that the person who he saw throw the tank top was a blonde man with long hair. But he did admit that he had given a contrary statement to the police at the time where he identified the person as Hispanic and, I believe, with dark hair as well.
The state did call the DNA examiner?
Yes, Your Honor. In terms of the DNA, well, first of all, obviously, as pointed out during defense counsel's argument, even without this tank top or without the knife, we absolutely could have obtained a conviction here that would withstand appellate review. We had all the eyewitness testimony and the cell phone video. But in addition to that, I think that the evidence, when viewed in its totality, does establish that this tank top was connected to the defendant. First of all, the DNA didn't exclude defendant, as I think it's kind of unclear in defense counsel's brief. But as to the tank top, there was a mixture of three contributors to this DNA sample, at least one of which was male. And the DNA analyst explained that there was just too much DNA, it was too complex of a sample for her to be able to pull any specific one profile out to be able to compare it. So it wasn't that Mr. Holman was excluded as a contributor to this DNA.
The blood was the decedent, so it had some relevance and tied to the observation of somebody in a white tank top. The knife argument is a little more interesting, if you could focus on that.
In terms of the knife, again, the state's first point there would be that even without this knife, a conviction should still stand in light of all the eyewitness testimony. It doesn't really matter whether or not the knife found at appellant's apartment was the one in question. But there is evidence to support the fact that this was the knife used in connection with this.
What was that evidence?
Well, first of all, the knife shape was consistent with the knife that would have made these injuries. The coroner testified that the knife that made these injuries had a sharp blade on one edge and a flat side on the other edge. And that was
most knives have that.
Well, sometimes they'll be sharp on both sides. So it kind of comes to a more of a rounded point at the top as opposed to having a flat side and a bladed side. So that's consistent. Additionally, the length and size was consistent. And also, in terms of the DNA on the knife, again, it wasn't that there was absolutely nothing there. The handle did contain DNA from at least one male, but it wasn't enough to compare it to anyone. And then the blade contained a mixture from two individuals, but again, it wasn't sufficient to compare. It was found in the appellant's bathroom, next to a bottle of nail polish remover, next to a sink and a shower. So when viewing everything in the light most favorable to the state, I think that there's enough to show that this was their murder weapon, but even if you don't believe so, it doesn't really affect the determination here because of all the eyewitness testimony.
Was there any objection to the admission of the knife?
No. And in terms of the autopsy photos, there were about 40 photos here, but first of all, as discussed initially, there was no objection. And when I went back and reviewed everything, refreshed my recollection, there was a substantial number of injuries here. There was wounds to the victim's face. There was three stab wounds on his chest, a stab wound near his belly button, a stab wound on the back of his shoulder, a stab wound on the back of his left upper back, stab wound on his right arm, cuts and scrapes on his right arm, and also defensive wounds on his hands. So there was a substantial number of injuries. In order to explain all of those injuries, we would have used those photos to talk about each injury with the coroner. Additionally, I would note that they weren't especially gruesome. These were clean in and out stab wounds that had been cleaned up. It wasn't an open gunshot wound or anything. Additionally, we didn't show any photos of the internal injuries after the victim was open and they were doing an internal examination. So we did minimize the grotesque nature of the photos and only used what was necessary for the coroner to talk about the injuries.
I have nothing else.
I have none.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Regarding the eyewitness testimony, it wasn't addressed one way or another by Ms. Weiberg or myself, but the from reading the record, the witnesses, it's not like they're sitting right here, you know, 10 feet away with an unobstructed view. The one individual that took the cell phone video was across the street on an oblique angle behind a wall. And I believe his testimony was that when he got to the end, he really couldn't see what happened. And the other witnesses, while I'm sure they believe what they were saying, there's a possibility that, you know, their vantage point wasn't that wonderful. So, as the court knows, eyewitness testimony can be suspect. I just want to address that. We're going to the knife, and I did not object to the knife coming in. That was a tactical decision because I felt the fact that the knife was found in Mr. Holman's apartment, that there was no blood, no DNA from the victim, there was no DNA, no fingerprints from Mr. Holman, that I thought it helped him. So that's why I didn't object to that. That was a conscious decision. Regarding the knife being consistent with the murder weapon, there must be hundreds of thousands of different kinds of pocket knives, folding knives. And speculating, there must be at least 5, if not 10,000 knives that would be similar, if not the same. And so I don't think that that is a valid argument. The identifications that were made were 20 to 45 minutes afterwards, and
the photo ID identification, was that in one of those six-pack?
I believe so.
Okay.
That was done later, and based on that, based on everything, we believe cumulatively the evidence was prejudiced. If the court has other questions, I'll submit it.
There's nothing additional. Thank you. We thank counsel for Mr. Holman, as well as the state, for the arguments this morning. This matter will stand submitted at this time.